I read this week about a family that recently received the news that their little boy has a terminal illness. There is nothing else the doctors can do. I think we'd all have to agree that that has to be among the most difficult trials, personal trials, that we could ever imagine. Who would have the strength to cope with something like that? Who in their own selves would know how to handle such a trial? That particular family happens to live in Belgium. So they have an option open to them that is not available anywhere else in the world. Just a few years ago, Belgium passed a new law legalizing childhood euthanasia. This past week, the little boy requested to die, and the parents gave their consent. And yesterday, he became the first child to utilize that new law. Tragically, that family just gave up and decided that they had no better alternative. That's a tragic way to deal with any problem. Indeed, that's a particular crisis that almost seems extreme. Sometimes, though, crises come in every life. Every day, trials come to every life. And every day, one of the options, sometimes it might even seem like the only option, is just to give in, to give up. The pressure's too great. It's more than I can bear. Well, Jesus also knows, as we find out from the passage that is before us today in Mark chapter 14, Jesus also knows what it is like to face a trial that is beyond what he could handle in his own strength. That's a little difficult for us to calculate, given the fact that, after all, he is God. But he's also man. And as a man, this passage makes clear he was not able to handle this in his own strength. One option could have been to give up. But Jesus knows a better way. In our passage today, he describes that better way, the better way to handle a trial. And if this works for a trial, this can also work for a crisis. It's a crisis that Jesus was facing that day, and he decided not to give up. He decided to utilize that better option that was not only available to him, but because he didn't give up, is also now available to us. This passage in Mark 14, Christ not only tells us, he demonstrates that God's grace is available through prayer for any trial and even for any crisis. God's grace is available through prayer. Now that is a fact. That is a spiritual truth. But just knowing that does not access that grace for us. This passage also is an explicit call that, based on that truth, you make the choice that rather than give up, rather than wallow in despair, you choose to access that grace. And you do so by seeking it from the Lord. Specifically, earnestly expressing your dependence on him. Now that leads us to a problem, an obstacle that stands in the way of each one of us to getting the very grace that Christ has made available to us. What's that problem? Many times we just don't sense the need. Just don't realize that we're facing a trial at any particular time, coming up any particular day, a trial that we can't handle on our own. That is either going to lead to personal despair or personal failure to accomplish God's plan and persevere through the trial. So Christ approaches that first problem for us, beginning of this passage, verses 26 to 31, as he reveals our need for prayer. That we cannot successfully meet the trials or certainly not the crises that are coming our way in our own strength. We need God's help. To convince us of that, we get this insight about a conversation that he initiated with the disciples. Verse 26 tells us that at the conclusion of the Passover meal and the Lord's Supper that we considered last week, they concluded, as was traditional in Jewish homes, to sing a hymn, and then they went out to the Mount of Olives. So picture them moving eastward from the old city of Jerusalem down the Kidron Valley and starting to go up. The Mount of Olives is a vast range of a couple of peaks. And so all this tells us so far is that they're on the move and they're walking up onto the Mount of Olives. While they're en route, verse 27 tells us that Jesus initiated this conversation and he said, "You will all fall away. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered." Now that was news to the disciples. It tells us already that Jesus knows your coming trials. In this case, he was revealing it to them ahead of time. Not too much ahead of time, but far enough ahead that when it came, they should have remembered he told us this was going to happen. It's going to happen in just a few hours, maybe a little bit less than that. This was very bad news for the disciples, that they were going to fall away. They were going to experience some hardship. He hasn't told them exactly what that is, but he has told them, and he has told us now, that God's behind it ultimately. The passage that Christ quotes from the book of Zechariah, this is God speaking. "I will strike the shepherd." Because that was God's plan. It was necessary for him to strike the shepherd in order to complete the plan of salvation. God says, when I strike the shepherd, I know what's going to happen. The sheep are going to be scattered. This doesn't mean God wanted the sheep to be scattered, but God knows human weakness. He knows that this is going to test them beyond their strength. And on this occasion, he knows one more thing. They are not going to ask for my help. There will be 11 disciples in the group with Christ that evening on the Mount of Olives, and not one of them will ask for his help. And so, trying to stand on their own, they will be scattered. You see, God's plan does include hardships. He knows that, and in general terms for all of us, now we know that. We know we are going to face challenges, and they come up every day, that we cannot handle in our own strength. Christ wants us to know that. He's informing the disciples ahead of time, not so that they'll just feel badly, but so that they will follow the example he's about to set and never venture into such a trial, never enter into such a day without God's help. Now, Christ offers hope as well in verse 28. God's plan not only includes hardships, it also includes salvation. It also includes triumph. As Christ follows that sad news about failure with the good news of restoration. After I am raised up, okay, the striking is going to be fatal, but it's not final. After I am raised up, he says, the resurrection is what he is here prophesying. Christ is confident of the future, but not just for him, he's also confident for his people. After I am raised up, I will go before you into Galilee. He's setting up a future meeting. That meeting, he will forgive his disciples for their failure. He will restore them to their place of ministry. Because it is God's plan that even when his children fail, he can forgive and use them again. This is very important to all of us because as we look back, we've already had that experience of failure. By God's grace, you have also already had the experience of forgiveness. That failure doesn't have to be final because of God's grace. So he knows the coming trials. He also knows our inner weakness. And if that's not clear enough already, the disciples are, in this passage, more than happy to express it in so many words, thinking that they can handle this one. In verse 29, Peter said to him, keep in mind, the Son of God has just told him what's going to happen. Peter said, oh no, not me. Even though they all fall away, and to Peter's shame, he's referring to the other disciples. I can see them failing, but not me. I'll be able to take it. I can stand. Even though they all fall away, I will not. What's shameful here is that he's contradicting Christ himself. Christ says, you're going to fall away. You are going to face trials you can't handle in your own strength. Not me. Not today. Can't happen. Is often the, if not our expression in so many words, our assumption. You want to argue with me on that point? Oh, I don't assume that. I don't assume that I can handle it on my own. Well, what would be our measure of whether or not that's true? This passage goes on to show that the measure that Peter, and as it turns out, the other disciples as well, were in fact assuming they could handle this on their own, is that they did not pray. They did not ask for God's help. You ever had a day like that? Ever had a day where, picture it this way. You're going through your morning routine. Maybe it's a little bit tighter schedule this morning than usual. And so you walk right past your place of prayer, whatever that is, wherever that is for you in your home. And you walk by that place, and now right now, picture, you might not have ever thought of it this way, but picture that Jesus is sitting there waiting for you to come and confess your need for his help that day with the trials that he knows you will face. But instead of stopping, you wave and say, I'm good today. Don't need his help. See, that's what lack of prayer, that's what lack of prayer says to the Lord. I'm good today. I think I'll be all right. I don't see anything ahead that I can't handle on my own, but if I find something, I'll be in touch. You can always leave that door open, right? So Peter responds in self-confidence here, expressing how we sometimes feel as well. And Christ responds to that by telling him, Peter, you are destined to fail with that dependence on yourself. Jesus said to him, and now he zeroed in on Peter because Peter is the one who has spoken. He says, truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And now this is worse. It's one thing for when the shepherd is stricken for the sheep just to run for cover. See, that's instinctive. That's natural for the sheep just to flee, trying to preserve themselves. But the claim that that's never going to happen now exposes Peter to a greater failure, the failure of actually denying a relationship with Jesus Christ. And not just once, which we might think maybe that was a mistake, but three times, a triple failure, and not some time off in the distant future. That's going to happen tonight. It's another effect here to self-confidence that verse 31 brings up. It's going to lead to obstinacy. In verse 31, he said emphatically, if I must die with you, I will not deny you. And now he is staking his claim. I can do it, Lord. I have what it takes. I can resist that temptation. I can withstand that trial. And then the other effect, it affects others. The other disciples heard this. And although they might not have chosen to say it on their own initiative, now seeing Peter say, I think I can do this. I think I can do that too. Self-confidence can spread. And rather than having the kind of influence on each other that we desire in our heart, I just want to be a help to fellow believers, others in the church family. Instead of being a help, a claim to self-confidence, a refusal to pray, instead can lead others to the same wrong conclusion. Peter and the disciples here aren't too much different than a man who stumbles and falls out of a high-rise building. And halfway down the building calls out, okay, so far. Okay, there's not much hope he's going to survive that. But that from his perspective, nothing's happened so far. I think I'm okay. We're not okay. We're not going to make it if we continue to depend on our own strength. The trials and the crises ahead are far, far too much. First problem, we don't sense the need. Christ says, you can't handle this. It's time to believe him. It's time to acknowledge, okay, I am in trouble. I don't have a real good track record. I have failed in the past. I failed this past week. Then what can I do? What is available that can actually make a difference so I can go from failure to faithfulness? What is available? Well, Christ now demonstrates that way. The disciples had not responded too well. They haven't gotten over that first hurdle yet, and Maybe we haven't quite yet either. But Christ goes on and gives the answer anyway and portrays now in verses 32 through 36 the act of prayer, the work that is involved with earnestly seeking God's help because I have a desperate sense of my own need. I am ready to acknowledge I need God's help every day, every new challenge. Christ now demonstrates what to do about it. In verse 32, and again, this is the part that is puzzling for us because we like to picture Christ as aloof from and above the powers of this world. We like to think of him as always in complete control. But his full humanity comes out in these verses. And Christ is not shy about admitting it. Mark describes it for us, and then he quotes the very words of Christ that make it clear he is feeling the weight of this. Verse 32, they went to a place called Gethsemane. This is about a fourth of the way up the Mount of Olives, near to the base. And the Mount of Olives is, in fact, a Mount of Olive trees. There are hundreds and hundreds of trees and various groves all across the Mount of Olives. Gethsemane is a word that means olive press. The usefulness for olives in the ancient world wasn't just to eat them as a garnish or along with the meal. They would do that as well, but they depended on the oil. And so with every olive orchard or group of orchards, there would be an olive press. It was at the place of the olive press that Jesus here came with his disciples. And apparently it's not the first time. Other gospel writers inform us that this was his custom to come to this particular olive press, that this was habitual for Christ. That all the disciples knew this well, and they knew what was going to happen when they arrived here. Jesus is going to pray. But they've never seen him quite like this before, because Jesus has never faced a challenge quite like this. And to let them know what is going on, he does some things that are perhaps unusual, such as in verse 32, telling the group of disciples to sit here while I pray. To sit here near the olive press, and Christ went on a little bit further, but he took three of his disciples, the inner circle that he often took with him. One time when he was going to be healing a little girl who had died. Another time was when he was going up on the Mount of Transfiguration. These were to be his witnesses. And so he selects that same three, as verse 33 tells us, Peter and James and John. Three individuals, ironically, who have voiced their self-sufficiency at various times. Peter most recently. But he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be, here's Mark's assessment of Christ's state of mind and heart at this moment. He began to be greatly distressed and troubled. Those are both very strong words. Greatly distressed. Very troubled in his soul. And then he expresses it in his own words in verse 34 as he said to these three, my soul is very sorrowful. How sorrowful? He says, even to death. There was a chance he wouldn't make it to the crucifixion because something is weighing upon him so heavily that he's not even sure he can survive. Now, what might that be? Is Christ concerned about his life? I don't want to die. No, it seems to be more than just fear of death. Christ knew what his death was going to mean. He knew that in just a few hours, he would not only be condemned to die on a cross by the Jews, at the Jews' request, and condemned ultimately by the Romans, but he knew that once he hung on that cross, he was going to become sin. Not just become a sinner, because he never sinned, but he would become sin. And for the hours that he hung on that cross, he would endure the full weight of the wrath of God against not just the sin of a man, but the accumulated sins of mankind. He knew that for that period of time, he would be separated from God. He has never been separated from God. There's never been a moment, going back not just to his birth in Bethlehem, there's never been a moment from eternity past that he has ever been separated from God. And that's the thought that nearly killed him. It's just too heavy a burden to bear. Do you see what Christ is saying here? I can't do it. I cannot move forward in this path in my own strength. But what is he going to do? He's going to pray. And now we get the insight from Mark's gospel of what it means to tell the Lord, I need your help. And you see, we're not going to be surprised that this is somewhat more than, dear God, thank you for this day. Please bless me today. Help everything to go well. See, that's just not going to do it. Instead, we have in verse 35, Christ separating himself by just a little bit, maybe going on another 25 or 30 feet away from the three disciples. And he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. Okay, that's imagery. The hour might pass. It's not just watching the time pass by and I just hope I can make it. The hour for Christ represented the fulfillment of the plan of salvation. And at this point, having focused on that all his life, now he says, I just can't do it. He's admitting his own weakness. That the hour might pass. In verse 36, we get his own words again, and he changes the imagery. He says, Abba, Father, all things are possible with you. Remove this cup from me. There's the other image. A cup that he has to drink. He's here saying, I don't want to drink it. It's too much. I don't have the strength to do that. And he says, furthermore, I know that you have the ability to take it away. God always has the ability. But Christ also knows it's not always his plan to make it easy. So he adds one more statement that is crucial to us. It's crucial because if he didn't say and pray this last part, we would have no hope. Yet not what I want, what I will, but what you will. Whatever you want is more important than what I want. And I will do your plan. And implicit here is, if you will help me. Willing to do the hard thing, go through the difficult experience. Christ is here then expressing his desire. That means it's okay for us. Tell the Lord the easier path that you can think of yourself. Rather than this, I think this would be better. But if that's not what you want, I submit to you. Express your desires to God, but ultimately express your submission to him. The ultimate priority has to be God's sovereign will. Now, Christ was in a crisis at this point. This is more than just a trial. We don't often experience crises, but we always, every day, experience trials. Okay, a student overwhelmed by assignments. It's just too much. Nobody could get all of this done. A mother could be overwhelmed by household duties. It's just too much. Even when everybody's healthy and happy, it's too much work. And then somebody gets sick and you just know it's going through the whole family. It's too much. A husband could be overwhelmed with pressures going on at work. Financial pressure because just so much uncertainty. It's too much. Can't do it. The example of Christ says, tell the Lord. Turn to him. Let him provide the help that you need today. If you don't ask, you can't complain that he doesn't provide that grace. Now, we often venture forth on our own, even though we know that prayer is available. And we bypass the opportunity. That's an option that Christ now evaluates for us. Wonder what he thinks about it when we just decide to go it on our own, even though we know that prayer is available. Verses 37 to 42, then, he confronts problem three. Problem one is we don't sense our need. Problem two, we don't know what to do. Well, now he's answered that, and we still have a problem. We don't do what we know. He has told us we need to pray, and still we neglect it. So he issues some rebukes in verses 37 to 42, and rebukes that we need to feel personally. First of all, he sees the sin of negligence. He sees it over and over again. Here he sees it for the disciples. He came and found them sleeping. Now he had given them an assignment. Watch with me. He was looking for people who would join him and support him in prayer. Were they praying when he got back? No, they were sleeping. And so, because all three of them were sleeping, this is probably that group of three, but he singles out Peter because Peter had been most vocal about his ability to stand. And here, the very first test, he's laying down sleeping. Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Now, probably, it doesn't mean that he was just then praying for a full hour. It's probably his plan over the next two cycles that altogether it would be an hour or maybe even a little less than that. So he ties it all together and say, Peter, I only needed your help for an hour. Couldn't you muster enough strength in that human resolve that you have in your heart to be faithful for an hour? Now the admonition in verse 38. Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. The flesh is weak, he says. You've gone right back to the need. So what should you do about it? You need to pray. Peter, James, John, every believer today, your flesh is weak. You need to pray. What happens if you don't? The weak become weaker. There's a cycle here. Weakness causes us to neglect to pray. And our neglect of prayer increases our weakness. Specifically, Christ had given them the assignment to pray for him, to support him, to watch with him. But now Christ adds in the additional feature that if you don't do that, you are in danger. I think we can put some things together here that lie behind what Christ is stating. He says, if you had just now been faithful in supporting me in prayer, interceding for me, watching with me, you would be stronger. What? But we weren't praying for ourselves. No, there's a principle here that when you pray and intercede and support others, you get stronger yourself. Okay, what's this tell us about the significance of, say, Wednesday prayer meeting? Okay, lots of things that you could offer as to why it really doesn't fit into your schedule. Yeah, I'm pretty busy, and I really don't sense the need. And yeah, I know a lot of other people have needs, but there will be enough people there to pray. And the end result? Yes, all those that come to pray will be growing in strength. And the one that doesn't get that benefit. You don't get the benefit of other people praying for you, and you don't get the benefit to yourself of praying for other people. Peter wasn't praying for Christ, and now he's in danger. So watch and pray, he says, that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. So they got the lesson this time, right? Now they're going to do better. Verse 39 says, he again went away and prayed, saying the same words, and again came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy. That's not an excuse. Oh, yeah, we understand. They were too busy. They were too tired. Oh, we have lots of excuses. This is not validating the excuse. It's just the only excuse they could offer. And they knew that wasn't going to work, so they didn't even know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, are you still sleeping, taking your rest? You still don't get it, do you? And now something remarkable happens. This third time, he says now, it's enough. The hour has come. The opportunity to ask for God's help is past. He says, behold, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Here's the remarkable part. The one who had said just minutes earlier, my soul is sorrowful to death. I'm in danger of not making it. But he prayed. He's now the one that says to the others lying on the ground, the ones who said, we can stand. We can handle it. They're asleep on the ground, and he now has to say to them, rise up, let us be going. Not because Christ is now ready to run for his life. Christ is now ready to march forward out of that garden and confront face to face the trial that is part of God's plan for him. Do you see the transformation? The one who admitted, I can't do this. I need God's help. Has gotten God's help. Now, God did not take away the cup. He's going to drink that cup. God did not change the circumstance. He could have, and it's right for us to pray that he will, because he could. In this case, the answer was no, I'm not changing the plan. But yes, I will give you the grace to do it. You will not have to struggle through this in your own strength. So the one who admitted he can't, with God's help, now he can. And he goes forth not quivering, not wavering. He goes forth with the power of God. And the others who said, I think we're good. We can handle this. They're the ones who get up quivering from their sleep. They are the ones who, in fact, are going to fulfill Christ's prophecy. They're about to scatter. The difference? The difference is prayer. So I'm not suggesting that the family in Belgium, who no doubt is not just grieving today, but perhaps also regretting their decision. I'm not saying that if they had known to turn to the Lord, that their little boy would be cured of his illness. Maybe not. But if they had turned to the Lord, what they would have found is that he could have sustained them, both the parents and the little boy, through all of the agony of that trial. But they didn't take that option. The question for us, the question for you, for each individual, will you take the option of turning to the Lord? Let's bow for prayer. Father, each one of us feels very keenly the sting of that rebuke. As we all have at times failed to depend on you. And so have stumbled and failed through times of trial in the past. Father, we ask your forgiveness for that lack of faith and dependence. And for your help now to follow the example, to access the help that Christ accessed and that he is ready to help us access today, every day, knowing that every day has these kinds of trials that are beyond our strength. Father, we choose Christ and the help he can give to enable us to depend upon you. So we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.